You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of October 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
Billy Bush not joining us today, as you're probably aware, part of that 2005 Access Hollywood taping with Donald Trump that's been in the news all weekend.
NBC, which owns Access Hollywood, has suspended Billy for his role in that conversation, pending further review.
The man who Donald Trump spoke to loses his job, but Donald Trump keeps his. My guests Samira Shackle and Matthew Green will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including Kashmir. It has been worse than usual lately, but how bad could it get? And Vice's attempt to reintroduce the evening news bulletin to the audience which seems least likely to watch it, their own. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are the journalist Samira Shackle, who writes for New Statesman, Deutsche Welle, and indeed Monocle, among others, and the journalist Matthew Green, most recently author of Aftershock, The Untold Story of Surviving Peace. Welcome both. We will start with Kashmir, one of those conflicts which never quite goes away and returns to the headlines every so often as if to remind us of how much worse it could get. The latest in a recent series of incidents has been a standoff between Indian soldiers and rebels who occupied a government compound in Pampore in the Indian-controlled portion of the state. That particular situation now appears to have been resolved after Indian troops retook the buildings. The wider tension has not. Samira, first of all, is there any particular reason for recent tensions? I know there have been, there was a terrorist attack against Indian soldiers. The Indian military killed Burhan Wani, the leader of Hizbul Mujahideen, but is it just those recent incidents, or has it been bubbling for a while?
I think it's always kind of bubbling in the background. As you've said, the immediate catalyst has been, first of all, Indian forces killing this young separatist activist in July, and then about 3 weeks ago, an attack on Indian soldiers allegedly by Pakistani militants. And so that's what's really, really stepped it up. But I think it's, I mean, there's always a kind of baseline of tension there about Kashmir, and it sort of doesn't go away and sporadically flares up. This is the worst flare up that there's been for about a decade, I think, almost. And it's sort of playing out, obviously, worst on people of Kashmir. I mean, there's a very, very, what we are sort of hearing about a lot is the trading of fire over the line of control and so on. But there is a really massive crackdown, Indian military crackdown on people in Kashmir, something in the region of 8,000 protesters, lots of them civilian protesters, have been arrested. There's been the sort of notorious widespread use of these pellet guns, which have killed and blinded people, in many instances, children, and just sort of quite a dire humanitarian situation on the ground there.
You're quite right, of course, to point out that the people suffering first and foremost from this are the people of Kashmir. Matthew, there will have been a cost as well to the night sleep of diplomats and politicians around the world. There have, of course, been three proper wars between India and Pakistan over Kashmir, 47, 65, 99. Are we worried about a fourth?
I don't think we're at that stage yet, but obviously these are two nuclear armed powers. So any time that tensions escalate, clearly, as you say, diplomats are going to have sleepless nights. I think what's going on in parallel in Islamabad is fascinating as well. I don't know if you've been following the story of a journalist called Cyril Almeida, a friend of mine, probably you know him as well,
yeah,
Samira, who wrote an extraordinary story a few days ago, an inside account from the Prime Minister's office where the Prime Minister or other very senior civilian officials were reported to be giving the leaders of Pakistan's intelligence agencies a real dressing down over their purported policy of continuing to aid and abet militants, whether it be focused on Kashmir or in Afghanistan. Now, obviously, in Pakistan, for the civilians to be standing up in this way to senior military figures is a pretty landmark moment. But Cyril has unfortunately taken a lot of stick for the story and is now on the exit control list, which means he can't leave the country. So I think that the internal political dynamics unfolding in Islamabad are really the key to understanding what's going to happen next.
Samira, Matthew does, of course, raise the salient point that both India and Pakistan are nuclear-armed powers. At the risk of sounding like either an insane optimist or a sort of cynical Kissingerian advocate of mutual assured destruction, does that fact actually now serve to make war less likely between India and Pakistan?
I do think there's definitely reluctance on both sides for a sort of all-out nuclear conflict. I mean, much as they hate each other, I don't think either wants to see...
They both understand that that would end badly for both of them.
I think so. And I think that... I think it sort of comes into play in sort of what Matt was talking about with the... with the sort of everything that's going on in Islamabad, there's this real sort of desire to control the narrative. And you see that on both the Indian sides and the Pakistani side. There's this sort of clash of narratives about who's doing wrong in Kashmir and sort of who's to blame and blah, 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 and so on. And there's sort of real sensitivities about the kind of information that's coming out. And it's almost like that sort of prevents tensions from escalating more, if that makes sense. It's a sort of vying over the story of it, and I think there's definitely a reticence about all-out nuclear armed conflict.
I did want to ask though about the controlling of the narrative, as you put it, because Matthew, the question with a situation like this is, to what extent, and it seems a slightly ingenuous one, but to what extent the governments are actually entirely in charge of it?
That's an extremely good question.
Because what has been noticeable is the, and you will both know this better than I do, the extraordinarily vituperative passions that this issue arouses in both India and Pakistan, quite cheerfully stoked by media on both sides. And at what point does that start to develop a momentum that a government finds hard to resist?
Well, that's the real challenge, particularly in Pakistan. Obviously, that was where I was based. It's the country I know better. You have a situation where you have an extremely large, robust military, but you also have the country populated with militant groups which are acting on their own autonomous agenda. And there's obviously always a question about to what extent they are acting independently or at the behest of elements within the security establishment. Let's think about Lashkar-e-Taiba, a very Kashmiri-focused militant group based in Pakistan, which conducted the Mumbai attacks in 2008. The leaders of that group are still wandering around freely in Pakistan, despite having large bounties on their heads by the United States. I met one of them, Hafiz Saeed, the founder and mastermind behind Lashkar-e-Taiba, and interviewed him. And I didn't manage to pick up my $10 million at any point, sadly. But, you know, it's clear that in Pakistan, these groups are still very much alive and well. For all the promises we've heard from the military about cracking down on militants without fear or favour, it just hasn't happened. And it's no wonder that India feels aggrieved.
Samira, just a final thought on this. Looking ahead where Kashmir is concerned, is there actually a role here that could be played by any actors from the outside world, whether regional power brokers or the UN? Or is this one of those situations which is either basically a resolvable, or to the kind where any attempts to help by anybody else are probably just going to make things worse?
It is one of those situations where it's very difficult to see what could be done. I mean, this conflict's been going on for the best part of 70 years now, since the partition of India in 1947. And I think obviously polling data is not hugely reliable, but the sort of limited data that exists shows that while there was widespread support for joining Pakistan before, increasingly Kashmiris want to be an independent state, and that's not something either side particularly wants to see out of India or Pakistan. And increasingly, that's what they want, self-determination. I think they're quite sick of being this sort of... point of contention between two countries that absolutely hate each other in the middle, and they kind of want to go it alone. And I don't really know sort of what the way forward would be, because I don't imagine that being tolerable to either India or Pakistan.
Okay, well, let's look now at the United States. pause for everybody at the table to sigh deeply. And though it is difficult to imagine that there are many subjects about which Donald Trump cares less, the films of Claude Chabrol, perhaps, the chorus of condemnation of his enthusiasm for sexual assault has now been joined by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. Prince Zayed Raad Al Hussein of Jordan described Trump's views as deeply unsettling and disturbing, and said that as president, the Orange Game Show host would be dangerous from an international point of view. Samira, first of all, if he does win a little less than a month from now, in how much of the world would it actually become quite difficult for him to operate? Because president of the United States or not, surely any leader, especially of a Western democracy, would realise that there would be a huge political price to pay for being seen to shake hands with him.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it really would cause, I think it's going to be, would be very, very difficult internationally for him to sort of get going. I guess the question would be whether the importance of the US as a global power would outweigh that. But I think it would certainly be very challenging. And there have been various articles sort of speaking to sort of representatives from sort of diplomats and so on from different countries around the world, all speaking anonymously about their massive concern about what a Trump presidency would mean. So I think it's definitely something that will be being considered around the world.
Matthew, notwithstanding the Trump presidency, is even the Trump candidacy damaging America's reputation and credibility? The idea is that America, as everybody knows, is a nation unprecedentedly, easy for me to say, powerful. in every imaginable respect, economically, militarily, diplomatically, culturally. And how do we end up at the point at which him, of all of its citizens, is going to be, well, we're down to two of all of its citizens, and he's one of them, who could be its next president?
Yes, it's a spectacular, isn't it, to even be having this conversation. Well, you know, we were just talking about crisis in Kashmir, but it feels like the United States is undergoing its own very particular type of crisis at the moment, doesn't it? And in a sense, the global sense of insecurity that spectacle is creating, I think, is resonating around the entire planet at the moment. As you say, with only a few weeks to go before this is decided. I mean, fortunately, all the indications seem to suggest that it won't be Trump. But I almost want to knock on wood saying that.
I will join you in that tattoo on the desk, speaking as somebody who I should acknowledge has been sitting here for the last year and a half saying, this is going nowhere. Donald Trump will flame out any tick of the clock now. There's absolutely no chance.
And I'm having a flashback to sitting with you in this very same room on the evening of the referendum after Nigel Farage had just declared, and we were thinking of knocking off early for the evening. So, yes, that's why I'm rather cautious. But having said all that, I think it's obviously very easy for us to get caught up in this kind of almost cartoonish reality TV style, very lurid personality, and how awful we feel about the fact that he's come within striking distance of the White House. But of course, it's what does he reflect? How has he come this far? The depths of disillusionment within the United States are obviously so extreme that we have to be asking ourselves in another 4 years, who's the next Trump going to be? Is there going to be someone a little bit more intelligent, a little bit more restrained, a little bit more sophisticated, who is going to play on exactly that same sense of alienation and take it all the way? So, you know, when Trump is consigned, hopefully, to the sidelines, the fact of this huge gap between aspirations and reality in the US and so many other Western countries needs to be top of all our agendas, I think.
Samira, we should address one peculiar subplot of the most recent Trump scandal, which is, of course, the hot mic recordings from a decade ago. Billy Bush, who I guess plays Boswell to Trump's Johnson in those recordings, has been suspended by his employer, NBC. Is that fair? In fairness to Billy Bush, who did sit there and giggle like an idiot, he didn't really say anything, and yet he's been binned by his employer.
It's a difficult one. I mean, I think I'm not actually personally that au fait with what he did or didn't say, so I'm not sure on the details of it. But I think if any employee has been in sort of engaging in a conversation that is quite explicitly about sexual assault, I think they can reasonably expect to be pulled up on it by their employer, if not sacked. And as President Obama quite memorably said in his speech, that Trump's comments would be inappropriate for someone seeking a job at 7-Eleven. So I think they're inappropriate for an NBC presenter to be in that conversation. It's inappropriate for a nominee for president. So I think that it's sort of... I believe NBC's justification was that he was sort of encouraging the comments and so on. But I do think that it's not wrong for someone to be pulled up for using such offensive language and talking about a criminal act.
Matthew, is this NBC taking a laudable moral stand here, or are they just attempting to limit damage to their own brand?
I suspect damage limitation is probably pretty high up on their list there. And there's a real irony, isn't there, for Billy Bush to be sacked, having perhaps saved the world, albeit completely inadvertently and not deserving of any real congratulation. But at the same time, maybe he was the arm of karma that needed to come and strike Trump this mortal blow with only a few weeks to go. So he'll go down with a mixed record in history. But nonetheless, he may have played a pretty big role.
Samira, I'm going to attempt optimism here as we look ahead to the break.
Brave decision, that. Brave play.
You would think I would learn, wouldn't you? But if the current polls are accurate and Donald Trump is on course to get fairly seriously duffed up a few weeks from now, is it actually possible that in terms of America's engagement with the rest of the world, President Clinton will actually enjoy a fairly substantial goodwill bump just out of a massive global sigh of relief?
You'd hope so, but on the sort of less optimistic note, you'd also have to hope that she's not going to, if she does win, not going to be hampered by a sort of noisy and sore loser in the background.
It's not easy.
Can't imagine him just being like, "Oh well, that's fair's fair. I'll be quiet and let go. We all gave it our best shot. I'll let it go." Can you? Really?
you have to imagine that if he does lose, his concession speech is going to be a collector's item, isn't it?
Yeah.
On that happy thought, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Samira Shackle and Matthew Green. Coming up next, is there anything the GOP could have done to swerve the potentially catastrophic Trump effect? Plus, some say Vice Media is mad for launching a new TV news bulletin, but could it bring some much-needed clarity to the generation of news by social media? Stay tuned.
The well-turned-out, style-themed October issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. We tour the globe for the best in the world of retail, with a ranking of the companies and developers doing it best from Sydney to Seoul, past Porto and Poznan. Here's what our sharp-eyed editors have spotted for you this month.
In the design section, we set sail to Copenhagen to see the striking modernist headquarters of shipping giant Maersk.
In the edits pages, we make reservations at a late-night restaurant started by the talented souls behind Apartamento magazine in Barcelona.
Monocle's October issue is on newsstands now, or guarantee your copy by joining as a Monocle subscriber. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Still with me are Samira Shackle and Matthew Green. Now, whatever the result on November 8th, the Republican Party is due what is likely to be a rigorous and rancorous period of reckoning. Either they will have nominated a manifestly unqualified Yahoo who led their party to defeat, or worse, they will have nominated a manifestly unqualified Yahoo who led their party to victory. The two questions they will be asking themselves and each other are: how could we have stopped it from happening this time, and how can we stop it from happening next time? Matthew, first of all, did the Republican Party make the same mistake that everybody, myself not excluded, did, of just underestimating Trump until it was too late, of just regarding him as a novelty and a nuisance and, you know, a self-promoting blowhard who would ultimately flame out.
Well, it certainly seems that way. But when it became clear that he was going to win the nomination, or rather, it became clear that the other choices were also, if not equally bad, were pretty appalling, actually, across the board. It's still senior Republicans who came out and threw their lot in with him. And now they're obviously reaping the consequences of that decision. We've seen this hemorrhage of support since the hot mic episode. I've lost count of how many it is now, but it's scores of senior Republicans and former Republican office holders lining up to condemn Trump. But one has to ask the question, wasn't it pretty obvious that this was the character of the man that you were supporting? I confess
myself baffled by the people who over the last, you know, 5 days appear to have suddenly thought, I say, this Donald Trump's awful.
Well, exactly. And it boils down to the question, doesn't it, of your party's interest versus the national interest. Now, we shouldn't underestimate how much visceral hatred actually there is for Hillary Clinton, and there is in the States, and that's something that I think in the UK we're so preoccupied with how just abhorrent Trump is that we forget that, but at the same time your country has to come before your party. I think we're saying that we're seeing exactly the same issue playing out with Brexit in the UK, where the reins have been taken up by a hardcore sort of rabid Eurosceptic faction of the Tory party who now seem to be dictating the agenda. And, you know, we have to be human beings rather than members of political parties. And that's something that a lot of people around the world seem to be forgetting at the moment.
Samira, as Matthew points out, a lot of senior Republicans have deserted Trump to some level or another, especially over the last few days. Could they actually sink him completely if they really wanted to? Or has he now... sort of broke free even of them? He does seem to be in a state of actual open warfare with the entire leadership of the party he's supposed to be leading.
Yeah, at this point, I don't really know what they can do. He sent that alarming tweet yesterday about how he's finally freed from the shackles and can fight for America the way he wants to, which indicates that he thinks he's been showing restraint thus far, which is a frightening thought. But I think, I mean, I also, as I think probably most observers of this was quite bemused by the fact that it was just the last sort of few days in which people have been lining up to condemn Trump. There were ample opportunities to do so before, not just when he sort of said that all Mexicans were racist or that he wanted to ban all Muslims from entering the US, that we should kill the families of terrorists.
We could be here a while.
Yes. Where was the line that suddenly things, they had to cross?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, suggesting that Hillary Clinton should not just be imprisoned but assassinated. And even things on sort of Republican flashpoints. I mean, some people have argued that this was the final straw because it offended white middle class women who are part of the core Republican constituency. But, you know, what about when he went after the Muslim parents of a soldier killed in battle? And, you know, that was sort of military pride and so on. That got some condemnations from Republicans, senior Republican leadership, but it didn't lead to people disavowing his candidacy, which I think is very strange. And as Matthew says, it really is a clear example of people putting their party interest above the national interest. And there's sort of been an incredibly sort of sharp division and along partisan lines over the last 8 years. And I think lots of people are worried about retaining their seats and not ceding any ground to the Democrats and sort of lost sight of the terrible, terrible situation being potentially imposed on the country.
Just a final thought on this one, Matthew. Is it the case that maybe now both major US parties, not just the Republicans, but the Democrats as well, who you can imagine might be vulnerable one day to an insurgency led by some, I don't know, nitwitted actor from Hollywood, do they need to revise their primary system to make it, you know, with all due respect to the wonder of modern democracy that is the American presidential system, do they need to take action to guard it against being hijacked by, from the fringes?
Well, yes, and we've seen, something clearly needs to change, doesn't it? If we're going to avoid this kind of outcome. I mean, regardless of where you stand ideologically, just the sheer character of the individual that is up for election needs to pass sort of some sort of basic human values test, doesn't it? Don't they? And the fact that we've ended up where we are shows that things need to be changed. But as I was saying before, it's just this sense of corrosion that the whole political establishment is suffering from at the moment isn't something that's going to be easy to fix, and it's going to require a lot of visionary leadership, I think, from Hillary Clinton. And the question is obviously whether she's capable of providing that.
Yeah, it's not just in America, of course, either. Finally tonight, we should move along. This week saw, on televisions which can receive HBO at least, the debut of a new evening news programme produced by Vice. The imaginatively titled Vice News Tonight goes out at 7:30pm weeknights. But who is going to watch it and why? Given that we are a room full of journalists, I thought I would ask you both, starting with you, Samira. The BBC, ITV, Channel 4 in this country all do a regular evening news bulletin. When was the last time you sat down and watched it?
Yeah, quite a while ago, probably. I think it's interesting decision to have launched this channel. I don't quite like watching those news bulletins when they're sort of if I'm near a TV and they're on, which is not that often probably. And I think, like most people, consume the TV news that I do consume is online. It's often in the form of short videos and so on. And Vice already had quite a big audience for that kind of programming, sort of documentaries and short films, which were shared online. And given that seems to be the way that lots of television viewership is going, not just for news, but for everything, it's interesting that they're trying to reverse the trend. And I think it hasn't gone that well so far. It's early days yet, but they've been running in the US for 6 months, and I think viewing figures are about half of what they were hoping for. So we'll see if it picks up. I'd like to see it succeed, but I'm not confident it will.
Matthew, do you regularly organise your evenings at home around the stentorian bongs of news at 10 or
I have
not?
To admit, I never watch it, ever.
Yeah.
I don't actually have a TV in the house. I mean, I watch TV online. I don't have a physical television set anymore.
It's that lovely old joke, isn't it? How do you know when someone doesn't have a television? They'll tell you.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, I mean, that's where we are now, isn't it? I mean, we watch the TV through the internet, and I pay my licence fee, or I recently started paying my licence fee when I realised you actually aren't supposed to watch it for free. But, I personally love Vice. I think they shine a light on stories, particularly in the UK, that a lot of other organisations are missing. You know, you'll read just random stories from the regions about... there was a great one a few weeks back about a kind of local sort of self-styled security chief in some old seaside town who'd set himself up almost as a sort of warlord to protect the elderly inhabitants from criminal gangs, but was really basically running an extortion racket on them. You know, that's original, interesting, from the ground reporting, which we want to see more of. Whether you can shoehorn that into the kind of old-fashioned style format that News at 10 uses, I don't know.
I mean, Vice, in fairness, have acknowledged that, quote, nobody needs this, but they're saying they're trying to add value. And in terms of addressing news in a news bulletin, Samira, how can you do that?
Well, I think they're shaking up the format, aren't they? They're not having a traditional sort of anchor-led news bulletin.
So there won't be an anchor or a desk.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think it's
radical.
Yeah. I don't know, really. I do think it's probably got limited appeal, the specifics of a sort of news bulletin format. I mean, like Matthew, it's not something I watch particularly often, and I am a journalist. It's sort of maybe if I'm at my parents' house or something, it might be on in the background, which I think says
I can't
it
really
all.
See my parents tuning into Vice News.
No, exactly. And that's sort
then
of
you never
BBC.
Know.
Yeah.
Well, that's a reasonable question, though. Is Vice kind of trapped at this point by its self-conscious youth angle?
Well, interestingly, the viewership figures for the US showed that, as I said earlier, it was about half of what they were hoping for, and actually the average viewer age was 40, which is well outside the age bracket that they're going for.
So basically what they're targeting is middle-aged people who think they're down with the kids.
Yeah, present company accepted.
Obviously.
I have written one story for Vice, I have to say, so I do feel like I've kind of got my finger on the pulse.
Really, though, I guess in the long term, my final thought on this, Samira, has the standalone news program reached the end of its tether in a day in which basically almost every television in the world will also get news all day, every day? Mm. Is there any real need for it?
Yeah, I think not massively. I think programs like Channel 4 News, you see, reaching massive new audiences by sort of innovative use of Facebook and short videos on that. I think that's sort of where things are headed. I don't think we'll be getting rid of news bulletins anytime soon, but I think that's the direction of travel.
And on that note, we will have to call it an evening. Samira Shackle and Matthew Green, thanks for joining us at Midori House. That is all for today's episode. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maria Khan. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. Music next at 1900, The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. More on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at 1800 London time tomorrow. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.